Hello, everybody. Charisse here with a very special announcement. I am thrilled to share that RCAT is now an official AIA continuing education provider. With this remarkable distinction, RCAT has launched RCATemy, a continuing education platform for the busy AEC professional. And here's the really exciting part. You can now earn continuing education credits by doing exactly what you are doing right now. That's right, you can now earn AIA credits by listening to select episodes of Detail. Whether you're working around the house, on your commute, or stuck in a waiting room, just listen, take a brief quiz, and your credit will automatically be recorded with AIA. It's really that simple. Plus, bonus points that much of our content qualifies for that elusive HSW credit. And we all know how valuable those are. What more could you ask for? We aim to please. Find out more at rcat.com/continuing-education or follow the link in our show notes. And thank you for tuning in to the RCAT Detailed podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
I've had the chance to work on projects where some of those goals since then were more explicit. But as I reflected on it, thinking about everyone coming and going through Walker Hall and thinking from the beginning just about how public a space it was, you know, thinking about accessibility in a different way beyond code, but really as a design opportunity, was something, you know, that I learned and do try to think about more in every project, regardless of the program.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Ryan Jang, AIA, principal at Leddy Madam Stacey Architects in the beautiful San Francisco, California. Ryan is the principal at Leddy Madam Stacey Architects in San Francisco and the 2022 AIA National Young Architect Award recipient. He specializes in diverse building types, primarily learning environments and higher education, but also affordable multifamily housing and civic and adaptive reuse projects. His passion for working with clients and meaningfully understanding their values allows him to facilitate an inclusive design process in pursuit of collaborative and uplifting architecture. His buildings strive to be an exuberant expression of the communities they serve and sensitively responsive to their cultural and environmental context. Ryan's projects have been recognized with multiple local and national design awards, and he has been an invited speaker at several conferences and design juries. The project we are talking about today is the Walker Hall Graduate Student Center at the University of California, Davis, or UC Davis. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Originally built in 1927, Walker Hall at UC Davis has been thoughtfully reimagined from a vacant, seismically unsafe agricultural engineering building into a dynamic center dedicated to graduate and professional students. Now at the heart of the campus, the 34,000 square foot facility supports academic collaboration, community building, and student well-being.
This building is Walker Hall at the University of California's Davis campus. And, you know, UC Davis, I've had a lot of friends and colleagues kind of go there, fantastic school. It actually started as the University Farm, a satellite to then the only University of California, originally in Berkeley. And so, of course, the University of California expanded to its several campuses that it has now, and Davis became a general campus in 1959. But prior to that, it was directly affiliated with Berkeley, you know, which is 60, you know, miles or so down Highway 80 here. And so this building, Walker Hall, was one of the original buildings on the UC Davis campus. It had a big sign on it saying agricultural engineering, and that's what it housed, the agricultural engineering program initially. It was designed by an architect, William Hayes, who had a practice in San Francisco, taught at Berkeley. He happened to be the supervising architect at UC Davis, you know, prior to 1950, and he designed Walker Hall, amongst other buildings. And so this particular building is located at the southwest corner of the original quad. Across the quad on the east side was North and South Halls, which were the first buildings on this campus. And so it was kind of across this open space from there. And immediately adjacent to the building is Hart Hall, another historic building, which is included on the National Register of Historic Places. Walker Hall is not included on the register, despite both those buildings being the same age. And so Walker Hall is a two-story Spanish-style building. It's shaped like an E, like the letter E. And the north face is two stories, which faces the street alongside the central quad. And the north face had offices upstairs and, you know, a traditional-styled, mission-style, you know, entryway with stucco walls, steel sash windows, a terracotta roof. To the south of the E shape, there are three clear-story wings that served as shops for hands-on research, for design, for fabrication, and there are courtyards that were working spaces in between the wings. And so a guy named, I think, Roy Boehner was the second Department of Agricultural Engineering chair after the namesake Harry Walker. It was actually really fascinating, the history. He would research and develop, and his teams and students would research and develop farm structures and agricultural machinery, including beet harvesters, tomato harvesters, hay bale loaders, tree shakers, cotton pickers, all these things that they would work on in basically this shop space. And so the campus ended up growing up around this building. The campus is expansive, you know, many buildings now. And so that agricultural land that surrounded the original building became what is now the modern UC Davis campus. And so in 2011, the building, the university had undergone a seismic study. It was deemed unsafe. It had housed other departments also, the design department, you know, in addition, in landscape architecture after agricultural engineering. But it was deemed unsafe in 2011. And the university decided to reuse the building, the historic building. And they decided to have it house the growing graduate student population, the graduate studies department, as well as included general assignment learning environments. And so the project received state funding for the seismic upgrade in 2012, and we were hired in 2014, and then the renovation finished maybe 2023, 22.
Central to the design of this project was identifying which bones of the historical building could be adapted for reuse, and what aspects needed a complete overhaul.
We did have to take out a lot. And when we first showed up, there was furniture still in the building, old papers, old classwork, old, you know, material, more than, you know, just the permanent built-in things. And of course, that all had to be removed. But I guess the point is that we took out, you know, really everything that was extraneous. So, you know, beyond that loose material, all the interior walls, all the original building systems, finishes. And we essentially saved the bones. We saved the structure of it, the concrete perimeter walls, the steel structural columns, which are also encased in concrete, the steel roof trusses, the second story structure. And we also saved the original entry doors, the original main lobby, and that main lobby leads to an original staircase and a skylight, which we saved. But everything else you know, actually including a full mezzanine in one of the wings, we removed and basically started over.
The redesign preserves the building's industrial character while introducing flexible, modern spaces. Many of these new spaces are dedicated to active learning.
When you start a project like this, there's so much of this process of discovery. You know, we talk about beginning by listening, and we really try to do that. The university had determined that this would be the home for the graduate studies department. Graduate studies was previously in a taller, older building in the main administration building of campus. And so they didn't really have a lot of their own identity at the time. You know, they had a place to go, they had their offices, but they didn't really have a home. And the graduate studies department serves over 7,000 graduate students at UC Davis, over 1,000 postdoctoral scholars. And, you know, it's really the kind of home base for 100 different graduate degree programs across the university. And so, you know, this is really the central hub for that population of students. The department guides and supports them, you know, everywhere from when they are admitted to the program to them finishing the degree programs. And so that overall department, you know, has different sub-departments in it: academic, financial, personal and professional support services, as well as all the spaces for the students themselves, you know, and offices for the deans and administrators. And so basically, the second floor of the existing building, you know, was dedicated to offices for the folks that I just described. And then we kept most of the ground floor for more public use. So the ground floor houses, you know, the actual Graduate Student Association and the Postdoctoral Scholar Association. And so a lot of that program involves meeting rooms, study rooms, quiet spaces to write, counseling spaces. And some of the larger spaces were a graduate commons and an event kitchen. And then separate from graduate studies, the university wanted to include general use classrooms and a lecture hall. So those are some of the most public and some of the biggest spaces in the building.
A cohesive integration plan was essential to connect the surrounding campus structures, linking the east and west ends to the new reimagined and retrofitted Walker Hall, which required a smaller footprint than originally planned.
The campus really grew up around this building. And so the north face of the building, facing that quad, facing the other historic building with its traditional entry, you know, was formerly the front door, if you will. And the back spaces, the kind of legs of the E-shaped building, were really the shop spaces. And they originally faced farmland and agricultural uses. But now on campus, the area to the south of the building, there's so much campus there. The engineering precinct, the physical sciences, you know, departments, chemistry, the main admin building, all of these areas are focused to the south of the building. And all of them came after Walker Hall was built. And then, you know, right to the east of the building is the Shields Library, the main library. And to the west of the building is the Student Community Center. I talked earlier about a home for graduate students. The Student Community Center next door is a place for undergraduate students. So the two buildings kind of now work together. And further west of that is the Silo Market with dining opportunities and this bus transit center. And so campus really wanted to establish an east-west connection between that bus transit center and the food service areas to the west. And they wanted this promenade to end right at the door to the main library directly east of Walker Hall. But there was one problem with that, in that Walker Hall literally was in the way. The wings of the E stuck out too far as compared to that desired axis. And it, you know, blocked the view corridor, it blocked what became, you know, eventually the promenade. And so not only were we trying to fit all this program into the existing building, the university came and said, well, we actually need to shrink the building. So, you know, the overall building became about 34,000 square feet or so. Originally, it was 6,000 square feet bigger, more around 40,000 square feet. And so we truncated the ends of the existing E shape to make way for this larger campus move, which was this promenade. And we worked closely with the campus planning department to do that. And now when you walk through today, you know, to be honest, I didn't get it at first, but you know, now when you see it today, today, it makes so much sense. And it became really one of the best architectural and, you know, kind of building and campus opportunities for the building, this idea of actually making something smaller than it was before.
Well, I would imagine that would be pretty challenging to have this, you know, this whole building. And all those buildings that came up around it obviously came up at different times over the history. And yeah, now you're reformulating this building and things probably don't face the way you wanted them to face, or, you know, or in the way of the progress that happened around it. So I can imagine that was not an easy thing to figure out.
Yeah, we really gave the building a new front door in a way. I mean, we preserved the historic entry and plenty of people still come in and out through the north, but so much of the energy, so much of the comings and goings, both through the building to the departments within, as well as for the campus as a whole, so much of the action happens on the south now. And that sort of flip was really transformational. And I think an example of how a building, even though it's there, can kind of change the nature of the campus beyond its own walls.
Luckily, the permitting process ran directly through UC Davis's internal departments in standardization, allowing for close partnership with the university.
The entire approvals process is internal to campus. So UC Davis and all of the campuses, they are their own authority-having jurisdiction. They are their own building department. They have their own fire marshal, which is designated from the state fire marshal, the campus fire marshal. And so it's really like these campuses, and I mean, with tens of thousands of people, it kind of makes sense. They operate as their own, you know, kind of small municipality, their own small towns. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, you can't, you know, you still have to follow all the codes and so on and so forth. And to your point, there are so many more standards that the university has, you know, in addition to code baseline. But it is a different environment working within a campus as compared to, you know, many of my other projects are, you know, within the city of San Francisco or Oakland or whatnot. I would say that the internal process is a fair bit more collaborative. You know, they're not going to give you a break, but at least they'll pick up the phone, you know, and at least you can, you know, sort of meet and work together and work through, you know, any unique or tricky things together. And that was one huge difference, where the authorities having jurisdiction, you know, are a partner alongside you and your client in working through this, you know, as opposed to, you know, other situations. And so we did have to go through the Division of the State Architect for Accessibility. You know, that was an outside, you know, entity, because the project received state funding. So it's just, you know, the way that it works. But otherwise, the inspectors were all, you know, UC Davis employees, the reviewers, so on and so forth. And we came to know them quite well. And that was one of the, you know, just knowing the people you work with, that was one of the great things about the project as well.
Functional yet expressive elements like steel sunshades, daylight collectors, and a sculptural stair recall the building's industrial roots, while the original concrete walls of the facade were largely preserved.
The existing nature of the facades were these solid concrete walls with punched openings, but the facades that faced directly south barely had any openings to them at all initially. And then we literally cut off those existing ends. And it's a little bit interesting. We cut off the ends to allow for the width of that promenade to come through. And where that happened to make the most sense was directly through an existing window. And so if you look at the photos, it's a little bit, you know, it's not a straight cut in a way through the existing wall. It's a cut that kind of jogs because there was a window there. And we use that as an opportunity. I guess I should say that our approach to transformation, you know, was a little bit unique. You know, on one hand, traditionally, you have this kind of preservation idea. And, you know, I just kind of came from the California Preservation Conference in Sacramento this last week. And, you know, there's so much value in preservation and respect for the Secretary of Interior standards for historic renovation. And, you know, we definitely respected that at that aspect of it, but we weren't really beholden, since the building wasn't on the historic register, to a lot of those requirements. And nor did we just put a big glass box, you know, into it as well. So what we tried to do was a little bit, you know, in between, where we cut off the existing building facade, we inserted, you know, a new program, and the classroom programs in the lecture hall, the most public elements of the program in the building, were placed along that facade. And we really wanted to display that energy and that the activity happening inside of those classrooms. So we went and filled back in the facade, you know, mainly with a glass curtain wall. And each of the three wings is expressed a little bit differently. The wing towards the west is the larger classroom, and it includes a glass clear story up above where you can peek in and see the historic trusses that exist inside. We extended the roof eave after, again, cutting off the building. It has a general a modest slope to it, but we projected that out as a cantilever, and it's expressed as this 4 or 5 inch, you know, very thin edge, responsive to the south-southern solar orientation. The middle wing existing was actually taller. So instead of doing the same thing as the east and west wings, we gave it this sort of facet to it. It kind of has this faceted geometry, and that responds to the shape of the classroom interior there, the acoustics and the need for teaching and so on. And then on the eastern end, it's kind of a cousin of the western end, where it's almost the same thing, but it's a little bit more glassy because the lecture hall was inside and it faced the lobby of the lecture hall instead of the classroom itself. So we tried to do this thing where each of the wings was similar, but, you know, a little bit different from one another. And, you know, back to that idea of context, you know, we didn't really try to mimic what was there or anything else, but we did try to compose the facades in a way that was deeply referential to what was there before. So the existing, so the new mullions, you know, kind of the curtain wall system, respect the proportions and line up with the existing steel trusses. The solid elements of the facade are a fiber cement panel rain screen, and they were solid because they were teaching functions on the other side of it, you know, whiteboards and monitors and so on. And, you know, we tried to proportion those elements in a way that respected the existing board formed concrete. So we gave it this horizontal linear expression. And then the canopies from the roof simply extend out. And then, you know, so the geometric canopies, and that was actually, you know, a lot of fun. A guy named Jake, who's no longer with our office, he was the one that kind of came up with all of that. But we basically took the existing roof form, which was a slight gable, a slight, you know, about half inch to a foot slope. And we extended that geometry, that angle, to create the geometry for those canopies. And then we, you know, kind of mirrored and rotated and faceted the planes, but all using a single angle, you know, and the inflection points became the posts by which the canopy was supported. And the canopies themselves, they kind of connect the wings of the E. So they just provide a little bit of shelter, a place to rest in the sun or to stay out of the rain in the winter for students waiting for class to in or out, because otherwise you would just go directly into the classrooms. And they also kind of connect to the middle wing, which contains the restrooms. And so if you're coming out of class and you need to use the restroom, you know, it just sort of connected some of the outdoor programs that might in another building be otherwise inside. And it also gives a little bit more definition to the courtyards, which are the entryways to the graduate student spaces.
Outdoor courtyards, framed by wooden sculptural canopies, extend the program beyond the walls, offering shelter and connection to nature.
Those are actually wood, and we worked pretty closely with the university to make sure that everyone was comfortable with the way wood patinas and changes over time. But one of the fun things about the existing building, which, you know, features these large steel trusses, but the original sheathing above the trusses was this beautiful, you know, of course, 100-year-old Douglas fir tongue and groove, you know, sheathing. And a lot of it, you know, wasn't in great shape. It was painted over before and so on and so forth. So on the interior, we didn't have a lot of ability to expose the wood in its natural form, although you do see it. But on the exterior, starting with those eaves from the classroom eaves, we took and recreated that that tongue and groove, Douglas fir, wood element as a soffit, and then we extended that to the canopies as its as its sheathing and framing. So the canopies are pretty simple, with a wood and steel structure and a just a really basic roof on top of it. Again, back to the idea of a public institution, the project did have a budget, and we needed to be economical in our choices, but it was an area where we could have a little bit more fun, at least with the form of it.
The roofing is comprised of steel trusses, plywood sheathing, and a rigid foam insulation.
The roof structure is the steel trusses with the existing tongue and groove sheathing, which we left, and then new plywood sheathing on top of that. And then on top of that, because we wanted to expose the wood to the interior, we introduced rigid foam insulation on the exterior for energy efficiency. So there's, at least 6 inches of foam up there, and the vapor barriers and so on. And then a built-up roof system that was specified and is a university standard, appropriate for a low slope roof. But, getting all that to work again in that existing context, getting all the new crickets to work, getting everything to drain to the downspouts and everything, you only have so much ability to change things because everything's existing, but you're adding all this stuff because that's what modern buildings deserve, such as insulation, but to fit it into the existing geometry was really the challenge here.
A key component of the project's design was the comprehensive seismic renovation. To strengthen and enhance the existing structure, buckling steel braces filled with concrete reinforce the ends of the building and protect against lateral seismic activity.
The project title, and its funding source was primarily dollars from the state for a seismic retrofit. We were able to do a lot more with it for the user group at graduate studies, so on and so forth. But the core task was the seismic renovation. So that is where we started with our structural engineer partners for L. Elsesser, who were fantastic, and so they looked at the building, its existing geometry, its existing construction, the kind of era that it was from. And again, it's this, it's not, structurally concrete, but the exterior walls are made of concrete. The structure is steel encased in concrete, and then the steel extends over as the roof trusses. So it's a combination of steel and concrete. The main challenge to the existing building itself was its shape. I keep talking about this E-shaped building, and the E-shape inevitably involves a lot of reentrant corners, inside corners. And this produced an eccentricity structurally. And, the building would tend to have too much torsion. It would tend to twist in a way that wasn't good for it in an earthquake. And so it was really the interior corners of the E that was the first focus for the seismic retrofit in strengthening those corners. And so we introduced some discrete and small concrete shear walls alongside the existing concrete to kind of hold it all together, and concrete pilasters, which are in addition to the existing concrete encased steel columns, to reinforce them at the corners. And then from those corners and from those new rigid concrete elements, there's a series of straps and plates and struts that strengthen the connections and drag those forces to the horizontal roof diaphragm, which we put new plywood on. And so from there, it was just about reinforcing a lot of the connections between the steel trusses and the concrete, between the wood diaphragm and the original tongue and groove wood back down to the steel. And so in a way that it was fairly simple, and our engineers wanted to take in a sense as light a touch as possible with the seismic renovation, because that's what the building needed, and that's what would be the most carbon efficient and cost efficient thing to do. Now, to support all the new elements, that was kind of another story altogether also, where since we truncated the building, we were leaving those ends even more exposed. And so there we introduced these buckling restrained braces, these V-shaped braces that are steel braces, steel tubes that are filled with concrete. The concrete is able to resist and dampen the force, the lateral force from an earthquake and compression, while the steel, of course, is very strong in tension. And so a buckling restraint brace, you don't need as many of them as with traditional braces, even though they are more expensive. So we had three of them, basically, at the ends of the building to reinforce it there. And you can see them, especially in the lecture hall wing.
The three former machine shop wings have been repurposed into a 200-seat lecture hall and two large, media-rich classrooms designed for active learning. Walker Hall also features a graduate student center that fosters interdisciplinary interaction and supports student well-being, with spaces for advising, mentoring, informal gathering, and mental health counseling.
As the home to the Office of Graduate Studies, you know, the second floor are the offices for all the folks and sub-departments. The offices are arranged in a series of enclosed private offices for certain staff and open workstations for others. And so the way that we arranged that was interesting, especially since our goal was to preserve the open nature of the building from an interior design perspective. But then, you know, moving downstairs, that's where the graduate association spaces are. And so, you know, there are, you know, more offices, but also their meeting rooms, their study spaces, their multi-purpose spaces. One of the larger spaces is this graduate commons space, just, you know, like a university union or something, a space. I mean, I don't know if they close the doors to undergraduate students, but, you know, in conversations from the beginning, the Graduate Students Association really wanted a place of their own for students of that demographic and a place for, you know, them to hang out, to have social events, to study. And there are so many spaces on campus for undergraduates, but despite there being 7,000 graduates on campus, at least before this project, there weren't as many spaces for them. So that was the primary focus of the ground floor, in addition to the general assignment classrooms. And there, you know, as it is now, we talked a lot with stakeholders about how to teach, about how to learn, the technology and the orientation of those classrooms to move more from traditional learning models to active learning and so on. And so that was, you know, another learning experience, you know, both for me and for all of us who worked on the project, to think about pedagogy and those things in that way. So there are two, one of the active learning classrooms seats 100, the other seats 80 students, and then the third is a lecture hall that holds almost 200 students. The active learning components of the teaching spaces. Those are some of the largest spaces and, you know, really some of the most challenging ones to adapt to this new way of teaching and learning within this existing context of a historic building. So it was the ends of the wings that we turned into the classroom spaces. The classrooms are large open spaces, but the idea was to bring the instructor as they would traditionally be at the front of the room, to really the center of the room. So instead of a series of chairs or tables and rows looking towards the instructor and a projector screen or a whiteboard or whatnot, the instructor was moved to the middle. There they had a podium, you know, where they can set up to teach and so on and control all the technology. And then there were two large projection surfaces on the north and the south walls. Those became the primary, you know, surfaces that were projected upon. Students from, you know, throughout the classroom can go and look at those surfaces. The students themselves were arranged in tables of eight, these sort of trapezoidal shaped tables that seat two people, but can combine, you know, four of them into a table that seats eight, or maybe it was 10. And the tables could be rearranged and separated and combined in certain ways, depending on whether the nature of the instruction was group-based or individual and so on. And then each of those tables had a connection to its own LCD display on the walls. And so each group of students could work independently in a group project or in a group project and talk about the subject matter and refer to the smaller screen on the walls. And so there were eight screens all around, eight groups of tables all around, and this instructor in the middle. And so what that really meant is that all of the wall surfaces were highly utilized. So we took the walls and covered them, you know, with whiteboards, basically, so that you could write on them, whether you were the instructor or the students. Upon the whiteboards were these LCD displays. And then in addition to that, there were these larger displays for the whole classroom. And looking to, you know, integrate that to kind of compose the spaces alongside the existing historic windows, the trusses overhead, and the new glassy facades facing south that we talked about earlier. That was, you know, kind of one of the more interesting compositional challenges, both kind of compositional from an architectural perspective, but as well as just like how to route everything, all the wires and so on and so forth.
Ryan and his team leaned heavily on the existing structure's aesthetics to guide the selection of interior finishes.
There, we wanted to just sort of let that existing building, which I guess has been the theme of this conversation, you know, become really the main star in all of this. So we tried to get out of the way, in a way, of those trusses, of the gabled roof, of, you know, even the concrete structure between the first and second stories. So a lot of the acoustical elements are fit in between the structure, in between the existing structure. You know, for the office configuration, again, there was this mix of enclosed and open spaces. And we introduced all the enclosed offices, or most of them, into this, you know, kind of spine inside the building, this like kind of tube running east-west. And that tube is clad with these kerfed green painted MDF panels, but that is a low volume within the overall space. It's about, you know, 10 feet tall, while the ceiling is much taller. And so we consolidated all the enclosed spaces within that central tube, gave them interior windows and everything to get that borrowed light, expressed that tube, that MDF finish in the paint color, and then really allowed the open spaces, such as the cubicles and the open offices, to fill the perimeter, such that we were able to preserve the overall volume of the space. And that really was, you know, kind of the primary move, which was, you know, to kind of get out of the way of everything that was there from an existing perspective and that we wanted to celebrate. You know, just in terms of the colors and the materials, I mean, they certainly needed to be durable, to be appropriate for a public university environment. But the graduate studies department always talked about this building as a new home for their department. And so, you know, we kind of just tried to take that word home and run with it as much as possible, especially in the furniture choices and in the kitchenettes and so on and so forth, and to make this as comfortable and as welcoming a space as possible for those graduate students and for the people who work in the building.
Many of the MEP systems were concealed for practicality's sake, particularly in regards to the extensive data cables and electronic components required for the teaching spaces.
I guess the HVAC system is sort of the biggest element, and that was all new. So it was a central air handling unit with direct outside air, you know, to be utilized at certain periods. It was a very variable refrigerant system with you know, fan coil units, which, you know, also had to be concealed inside the building, that then distributed the treated air, you know, throughout. It's a pretty, I guess, you know, common system. You know, right now we also adapted it so that it could be all electric. That was, you know, this is maybe a little bit of a side note, but we were transitioning from gas to electric on the campus utility level. So the systems also had to be somewhat adaptable in that sense. But the systems were, you know, chosen for their efficiency, but also for their effectiveness. You know, Davis can be quite hot in the summer. It can be quite cold in the winter. And so the systems really just, you know, needed to work well. And so there are actually, if you look at the aerial photos, large equipment wells, and, you know, the air handling units are quite large, and they're on top. And then, you know, maybe more with regard to, and so electrical was all new too, and low voltage and telecom was also all new. And a lot of that was, you know, to support the general power for the building, but also all of the technological systems in the classrooms. And so that was, you know, another interesting part of it, which was like how to, you know, for example, route all these data cables, you know, around all those displays that I was talking about earlier. And if you look actually closely at the pictures of the trusses, there's a we added a black box that's underneath a box and cross section for we adapted a traditional cable tray and used one of these raceways that we mounted it. It was the exact width of the existing truss, and we mounted it to hide all those wires, which of course are a variety of different colors. And that's how we routed all the wires to all the displays and so on, so you didn't, you know, see a whole bunch of wires running throughout the existing space, especially since we didn't have the benefit of a suspended ceiling in most of the building. Plumbing, we tried to consolidate in a way as much as possible. You know, all new restrooms, I mean, we were, you know, kind of increasing the occupancy of the building by many times, just with the volume of students coming in and out. So yeah, absolutely. A lot of restrooms, a lot of roof drains, a lot of distribution, you know, for other things like kitchenettes and so on and so forth. The plumbing, in a way, was kind of the easiest because we were able to locate those elements in a way that we could conceal the routing. It really was the low voltage and the electrical that became, you know, and almost always is the most challenging. And I think, like, for us, it's, you know, you can't make it like disappear. You can conceal things and it becomes difficult when you're penetrating through structure and so on and so forth. And you can hide things as we did above acoustical panels and so on. But a lot of it, you know, you really are just going to see. And so to us, it's just about composing it and organizing it and making sure the hangers are just so, and making sure the screws are mounted and the colors kind of make sense. So it's not really about making it go away necessarily, but it's about composing in a way that makes sense. And that really is, you know, kind of the challenge in a way, and the extra effort that this type of building or this type of aesthetic demands. And that gets back to the sort of assemblies and the nature of the existing building, where, you know, the existing building had an existing floor slab. We did a fair amount of foundation work. So some of it was dug up, and other areas were not. We ended up putting a layer of gravel on top of the existing floor, generally speaking, routing a lot of the electrical and voltage, low voltage elements through that gravel layer, and then pouring a new concrete slab on top of it. Because of the site configuration, we needed it to be a little bit higher than what it was originally, again, for water infiltration and so on. So there's a vapor barrier there as well. But that actually became a good opportunity, you know, and in a way a challenge with the contractor to try to get everyone to route all these things in the floor and to think about that aspect of it, you know, well before the contractor and the trade partners are interested in thinking about, you know, power distribution. But we needed to do that knowing that the ceilings would be largely exposed.
Although the initial goal was LEED Gold certification, the project exceeded expectations by achieving LEED Platinum without added costs, demonstrating how practical sustainability can lead to exceptional outcomes.
You know, you always want to underpromise in your projects and try to overdeliver where possible. And so in a way, I guess we had these internal goals in the office, you know, between the project team, and, you know, there were sort of the external goals that, and you know, we did talk about those internal goals with the university as our client, but we had those stated external goals and, you know, kind of minimums that were set by university standards and so on. And so in a way, we had this goal to be as high performing as possible from the beginning. But, you know, we really didn't know if the budget would work out quite right. We didn't really know, you know, about all the circumstance and things that changed through a long project like this. And so we were fortunate to have met them on this project, but it did, in a way, require us to have those standards, high standards for ourselves from the onset, even if, you know, kind of the public targets were a little bit more modest. I mean, I guess that's kind of the big secret. But beyond that, you know, I think that collaboration with the university was kind of a key element, and their support for sustainability measures was really essential to get the Platinum certification and so on. And specifically, you know, in that there was like the building itself, and you're trying to do everything you can. But there's also the story of the campus utilities and working, you know, within the bigger campus infrastructure and understanding how our building is simply a piece of that. And, you know, for LEED or for, you know, the publications and so on, it's about telling that story about how our building isn't just a building sitting in the middle of nowhere. It's really this kind of interconnected system. And for us to learn about that, to kind of literally tap into that from the perspective of utilities, but, you know, to tell that story became really important. So for example, you know, we didn't have photovoltaic panels on top of our roof of the historic building, but UC Davis does have this immense PV farm, this solar farm on land that they own. And so we were able to dedicate literally a section of that farm to provide the power for our building and take advantage of that in the energy credits for LEED. Similarly, taking advantage of the heating hot water and chilled water loops for the utilities of the building and, you know, not having to have our own standalone systems, but to use this process energy, which, you know, was being made more and more sustainable and more efficient, you know, as our own project was being brought forth. And same goes with wastewater, same goes with stormwater, and so on. And so integrating it into the system became, you know, kind of a key thing that we tried to take advantage of. That and kind of emphasizing the carbon emissions and carbon kind of reduction measures that we were able to use by reusing the building, of course, instead of building a new building. And we knew this intuitively when we started the project in 2014. But, you know, now with like C-Scale and other companies that are out there, we can talk about carbon and analyze it really in our buildings in a much more sophisticated way, you know, so we were able to do so after the fact, as compared to, you know, even when we started the project. And you try to price those things in from a systems perspective in the beginning. And, you know, in California, we are somewhat more fortunate in terms of our code minimum standards, which, you know, may be higher than other environments. So, you know, when you're talking with your client, when you're thinking about the cost model for the project, when the baseline as required by code is higher than it otherwise would have been, or even when the university's own internal standards are higher than they otherwise would have been, it closes that gap. And it means that you don't have to do as much, you know, so-called extra to get there. And so, I mean, you know, so it wasn't some sort of magical thing. It was pretty practical in a way.
Integrating all program elements within a clear and concise layout posed a major challenge in the overall design.
This is public work, and that this is our client was a public institution, you know, lots of stakeholders. And so the most difficult thing when we started, and I think this is why they hired us in a way, because of our sensitivity to it, was how we were going to fit everything they wanted to fit, you know, programmatically inside this new building. And, you know, you can kind of extend those programmatic items, which is, you know, the classrooms and the offices and everything, to also thinking about, you know, new building systems, the new seismic elements, the new envelope upgrades. So really, when you kind of take it all, both the things that people actually experience as well as the support systems, you know, the question is, like, how do you fit all of this stuff into these existing walls and this existing roof? I mean, it's kind of a classic thing. You can't really change, you know, the floor to floor heights. You can't really, I mean, you know, you can add on to a building. That wasn't really an option for us in this case, but you can't, you know, really push beyond what is already there in a renovation project.
Similarly, the construction process unveiled surprises when considering the existing structure's unique measurements and parameters with new design elements that didn't initially align.
What I've realized, and from doing this on other projects too, is that nothing is really flat or really straight. Nothing's really level or plumb. And, you know, that in an existing building. And, you know, in a new buildings, you can specify certain standards and, you know, make it such that it's within tolerance to install your floors and, you know, your walls and deflection and so on and so forth. But in this building that's been around for 99 years and built in a very different time with different materials, you know, nothing's straight. And so everything new that you put into it has to interact with those existing surfaces that aren't level or plumb. And so, you know, even when you put in the interior doors, you know, you kind of think, well, doors are pretty simple. You specify them, you detail them, you have your jam in your head and your threshold, and you say, we need 50 doors, and here are all the hardware groups or whatnot. But, you know, when we put in these doors, we framed all the head heights, you know, kind of level, but the floor kind of underneath it was kind of wavy, and some spots were higher and some spots were lower. So what do you do with the bottom of the door frame in that situation? How do you get the door thresholds and any acoustical requirements to work? You know, how do you kind of get it to sort out between the factory and, you know, or do you modify it in the field? And so, you know, these things that are, you know, often maybe taken for granted or otherwise just more simple in new construction just become, you know, these issues of scale, especially if you have a whole bunch of doors. And, you know, maybe the other one was some of the existing windows. So the existing steel sash windows, you know, were single paned, and, you know, we replaced them from, and we intended to from the beginning with a modern product, but they had existing rough openings. We took the existing windows out, and the whole exterior of the rough opening, not only was it not plumb and not level, but it also crumbled because the original concrete was kind of cast in a certain way and plastered over and mortared over in a way where they set these existing windows, you know, into the secondary material, which actually wasn't structural. And so it cracked away as we removed them. And so we had to kind of reform and rebuild them and give a suitable substrate for this, you know, modern Conair window to get set into with a certain tolerance for the joint sealant and, you know, for air infiltration, structural connections, and so on. And, you know, so they're just, you know, you can kind of go up and down the construction divisions, but there are just countless examples of the effects of lack of, you know, straightness. And, you know, again, things have changed a bit since, you know, we started the project in 2014, you know, and now, you know, we do remodel work fairly often, but now we can, you know, pretty economically get a company to come in and take a cloud scan of the existing building, and we can kind of capture all those imperfections in our digital models, and we can account for them a little bit better. In this particular case, some of that technology wasn't really around, or it was, you know, maybe more expensive back then, you know, and some of the public procurement requirements of having contractors go in early and, you know, like, you know, in hindsight, if we were able to clear out the building and do some of the demolition in advance or whatnot, you know, that would have been a bigger advantage for the overall construction project earlier, but the public contracting laws required that we, you know, have one contract for construction, so on and so forth. So there are some procurement issues around that too, which aren't always kind of physical in nature.
For Orion, the realization of how extensively the public space is used by such a diverse and multifaceted student body proved deeply profound.
I think that now, after seeing the building in use after a couple of years, one of the things that I'm amazed by is how much it's used, how many people, whenever I come to visit, come in and out of those classrooms, come in and out of that graduate commons. It really is this public space, at least to the university. And so what I've also come to realize, I guess, is just how diverse the people are that come in and out, different majors, different backgrounds, different, you know, ages, different life experiences, and so on, but also, you know, diverse in terms of neurological diversity and like physical ability. And so, you know, as an architect, both in school, back to your original question, and in practice, you know, we do our continuing education, we, you know, try to meet the ADA standards, and we, you know, design to those codes, but we weren't super explicit about this from the beginning of the project, but it did come at the end of it to form some of my own thoughts around universal design, around equity of access for space, and creating, you know, in an environment that can be as welcoming and as broadly accessible to the diverse range of the human condition, you know. And so we did think about some of those things in the beginning, particularly around equitable access, especially within the historic building, we, you know, removed some of the front steps from the historic entry, offered a sloped walkway instead, we put a new elevator in the building, and that elevator was directly opposite, just mirrored across from the existing historic staircase, so that the kind of path from the first to second floor was as equitable as possible, whether you could use the stairs or not. So you kind of turn left and you go to the stairs, you turn right and you go to the elevator, and you kind of meet back up at the same place up top. The elevator was not hidden off in the back somewhere. Similarly with access to the stage from the lecture hall and so on. And so, you know, I've had the chance to work on projects where some of those goals since then were more explicit. But as I reflected on it, thinking about everyone coming and going through Walker Hall and thinking from the beginning just about how public a space it was, you know, thinking about accessibility in a different way beyond code, but really as a design opportunity, was something, you know, that I learned and do try to think about more in every project, regardless of the program.
With seismic safety reinforcement, transformative sustainability efforts, and renovation that retains the building's industrial heritage, Walker Hall now stands as a model of the power of adaptive reuse and the role of design in fostering resilient, student-centered university environments. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I wondered whether Ryan sees adaptive reuse becoming more common in the industry, and if so, what key factors are influencing that shift?
I think it's moving, you know, in the direction of adaptive reuse, of preservation, of renovation of projects. And you can't always do it, but you know, I think it's probably a couple of things. One obvious thing, at least in the campuses that we work on and, you know, in cities like San Francisco, you know, space is limited. So, you know, reusing what you have is kind of the practical thing to do. But beyond that, you know, I think that the priorities and changing values around climate change and around the embodied carbon equation that we talked about earlier are, at least for our practice, becoming, you know, more and more important, more and more, you know, essential. And someone who I'm inspired by in this area is Larry Strain, another local architect at Siegel and Strain. And, you know, he's developed this, you know, super simple calculator about carbon. You know, if you're, you know, an architect or a building owner, you know, should I do nothing to my building? How much carbon will that take? You know, maybe it's an inefficient building and the systems, the air conditioning, you know, is going to be inefficient or whatnot. If I do nothing, should I retrofit the building and how much, you know, carbon would that take? And, or should I rebuild a new building? And so, you know, the premise of that question, I think, is such a good one and such one that all of us in the industry, whether we are the architects or we're on the owner side, should, you know, really be thinking about hard, because that embodied carbon in an existing building is literally already there. You don't have to bring it in from somewhere else, even if it's the most sustainable material in the world. And so, you know, I think that that's something that's changed, you know, for me personally and for our practice. And, you know, I think sometimes architects will think, you know, about design freedom in a new building and the opportunities that you have to create something new, you know. But, you know, I think that it's way more of a challenge, and maybe our discussion has illuminated that, to turn something existing, maybe it's not so nice when you inherited, into something that's beautiful and that's functional. And that is, you know, just such a challenge and such an opportunity, you know, maybe even more so than being able to create something new. And that's something that, you know, we've embraced, and I hope to do so more and more in the future.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Ryan. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I feel like in my mid-career, I've, you know, done some things so far. And, you know, hopefully we'll have opportunities to do more for the next years and decades and projects and so on. You know, I just saw recently that Chuck Davis, the founding partner at EHDD in San Francisco, passed away. I had the chance to meet him, but also to hear from him at last year's Monterey Design Conference. And it was this, you know, great reflection on his career and his work and everything, you know, that he's done. So I guess the simplest answer is that if I have the opportunity just to keep working and doing what I'm doing in big or small ways for a career that lasts years or decades more, that'll be, you know, just enough, you know, and that'll be great just to be able to have that opportunity to have practiced for that long. And, you know, I think beyond that, you know, our office and my career, my life has been, you know, focused here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's the city that I grew up in, and I'm privileged to be able to practice, you know, in the city that I grew up in. So, you know, I haven't done, nor do I think I really want to do, you know, museums across the country or skyscrapers in other continents. So just to be able to impact the communities that are here that I grew up in or around is, you know, a fantastic opportunity. And this is, you know, where I'm raising, you know, my family. So, you know, I kind of think, of course, about the world that my 3-year-old will grow up in, you know, whether it's political or environmental or social or, you know, physically, like the, and, you know, to be able to let my work and the work that we do as an office, especially around areas of like sustainability and resilience, you know, impact and leave for them, you know, younger people, younger, different generations, a better and still sustainable place, that would be all I could ask for.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.